presentation of a novel idea on KRCB.org is made possible by our members and by SolarWorks, helping homeowners, businesses, and communities conserve resources and save money for over 21 years. Information on going solar is available at SolarWorks Downtown Sebastopol office, 707-829-8282, or online at solarworksca.com.
Welcome to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. I'm here with Suzanne Lang, the producer of the show, and tonight we're doing something special. We're bringing you a retrospective of Novel Idea. We're celebrating 5 years of Novel Idea on the air. Now, this is a change of plan for what we had thought we'd do this evening. But remember, change is in the air. It's the word du jour. The show that we had planned to bring you this evening, Rising from the Rails, the story of the Pullman Porters and the making of the black middle class. The book is by Larry Tye, and we have postponed this show for a very good reason. We found the perfect guest to bring this story to life, and he was not available in time to do the show. So we'll bring that show to you another time. But could I suggest that you go ahead and get the book and read it so you'll be prepared for our discussion? You can do your homework. The book is Rising from the Rails by Larry Tye, T-Y-E. But tonight we're going to take a little trip down memory lane. I was looking at the bookshelf where I keep the books that we've done on Novel Idea, and I just thought I'd lift up some of the titles that we've covered. Perhaps you remember Life of Pi, The Secret Life of Bees, Kite Runner, Reading Lolita in Tehran, The Great Gatsby, Cave Dweller, Saving the World, Aragon, Can't Quit You Baby. Many of these shows are available on the website, krcb.org, and they are in the archives. And we invite you to visit the website and listen to some of those programs. The first of our historic programs that we want to talk about tonight is a program with Alexander McCall Smith. You recall that he's the author of the Ladies' Number One Detective Agency series that takes place in Botswana. The stories have been extremely popular. I think he's written about 8 in that series, and then he has another series going that takes place in Scotland. He has a worldwide reputation, and we were just delighted when we found out that we were going to have an opportunity to interview him when he came to Copperfields in Montgomery Village. And Suzanne, I'm sure you remember the scene in the storeroom there at Copperfields. And we were sitting there waiting for Alexander McCall Smith. He'd called in to say he was late.
And he came in with quite a large presence, I recall, and such a refined gentleman. And here we were in this back storeroom with books piled up. It just seemed very verschimmeled back there, but we had our chairs and you, and he sat knee to knee practically.
Yes.
And what I recall about that conversation between the two of you was almost an instantaneous rapport that seemed so apparent, and I thought it was partly because of your expressing that you yourself lived in Africa.
Yes.
and shared that common experience with him. But also, and as the listeners will hear, you struck something in him when you talked about the characters and your relationship to them and how real they were for you. And the two of you, it was like you were talking about family members, because he was talking about the characters in the same way, in such a personal way. And the rapport between you was just great.
Well, he's such a fabulous person to work with. In the first place, he's so professional. I'm sure that he was a little bit harried from being held up in traffic and being late. And after all, there were 50 people at least sitting out there in Copperfields waiting for him. I mean, he was the evening's entertainment for them, but he was giving us this this interview first. But he didn't seem pressured or hurried. He just got right into the material and gave us quite an in-depth interview. And we talked about some very serious matters about Africa. I was just delighted with the conversation.
And it was in marked contrast to his demeanor and presentation when he was in front of the crowd. He was probing and refined and thoughtful when he was speaking with you in the cramped storeroom. And then he goes out into the crowd and it was like he was a stand-up comedian and he was milking the crowd and obviously enjoying that too. So it was surprising to us, though, I think.
Yes. And it was wonderful to watch. The crowd was so responsive. And of course, the people in the audience were readers who were so familiar with his work and pressing him to find out what he was going to write next. And it was a lovely evening. Something interesting happened just when our interview ended. I told him off mic that he had fans in China. And he looked quite interested. I said, well, my daughter-in-law teaches in the international school in Beijing, and I send the books to her, and they're passed around, and all the faculty there is very excited about your books. And he said, well, I think that they should have a set of books of their own in the library there. And he gave me the email address for his secretary, is. Whoever it is that takes care of these things, and said, email her and tell her that we spoke and ask her to send a set of books to that school and ask her if she has the ones that I've autographed to send those.
And did they?
When those books arrived at there are about 5 or 6 international schools in Beijing. So when they arrived at the school where my daughter-in-law teaches, she said there was tremendous excitement. Wasn't that a lovely thing for him to have done, to respond in that way.
Oh, yes.
And he's just that kind of person, as you'll see when you hear this excerpt from our interview with McCall Smith.
Yeah, let's take a listen.
Okay.
The beginning of that novel, The Number One Ladies Detective Agency, contains a nod in the direction of the great Karen Blixen, who wrote, as Isaac Dinesen wrote, the marvellous Out of Africa.
Yes.
And, of course, the first line of the Blixen book is, I had a farm in Africa, at the foot of the Ngong Hills.
Yes.
Marvellous, resonating phrase, that.
Yes.
And so I start off by saying, Mara Matsui had a detective agency in Africa at the foot of Khali Hill. Which I suppose I'm trying to evoke the same sense of the spaciousness and the pace of life and the air and the light. And then, of course, we rather change gear and it becomes rather different from Out of Africa.
Mm-hmm. Ma Ramotswe, a traditional size woman. People probably often ask if she's based on a real person, but I'm not going to ask you that. I'm going to tell you that, to me, she is a real person.
Well, there you are. Maybe she's become a real person.
I feel like she's my new best friend. It's just such a treat to spend time with her.
Yes, well, I'm glad that you're enjoying your sessions with her. She's the sort of person one would certainly like to have a cup of tea with.
Yes.
And I think that also people feel that she's the sort of person who would like them. I feel that Mara Matsui would like most people whom she meets, and I think most readers feel that if Mara Matsui came to sit down with them, that she would be quite happy with them, and vice versa.
And that would be a cup of Redbush tea, of course.
Cup of Redbush tea.
Yeah.
Mara Matsui drinks Redbush tea.
Yeah.
She prefers that to ordinary tea. She doesn't drink caffeine, and so she thinks Redbush tea is a good alternative.
I like Redbush tea very much, and fortunately we can get it right here in Sebastopol.
Yes, well, yes, you can. I think it's becoming increasingly popular.
It certainly is.
In fact, I had a letter from the people who grow it and produce it last year, and they said that since the publication of the of the books, the consumption, world consumption of red bush tea had gone up by 70%. So I think Maramatsu is very good news for them.
I was struck by the universality of her appeal, although she's definitely an African woman in every respect, and yet her appeal is to men and women all over the world, I think would just find, as you say, a person that they'd like to talk to.
Yes, that's a very interesting point, and thank you for those remarks. I think that she is a person who probably embodies certain values of universal significance, in that I think we all like the idea of somebody who is sincere and a direct speaker, but who's kind. And who also believes in forgiveness, because that's certainly something that Maramatsu believes in quite strongly. Mm-hmm. And so somebody who is kind and who is sympathetic, mm-hmm. as she is, obviously is going to appeal to a fairly broad number of people who would perhaps be rather fed up with the aggressiveness and the painfulness of our modern world. Yeah. Maramatsu represents an antithesis to that, and so I think that might be one of the reasons why she's so popular. And certainly the Maramatsu books are being translated into 34 languages, so she's very popular in Iceland, for example, and elsewhere.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yes,
well,
yes.
Why not?
Well, indeed, right. Indeed. And I think possibly people who read about her, in whatever culture they read about her, they can picture somebody who would be familiar to them, who would be a sort of Maramatsu. Mm.
I was so pleased that early on you told the story of her father, Obed, and a little bit of his life, which of course gives one the history of that part of the world.
Yes. Her father is a very good man, a very fine man, and he represents, I suppose, in her eyes and maybe in the reader's eyes, all those very fine traditional values that one found in Africa. And he was just a very, very good man, hard-working man with a great eye for good cattle, which he puts to good effect. And her relationship with her father is very important with her father's memory, because he's no longer alive, and she thinks of him every day. And I find that quite a nice idea, that somebody would have in their life the memory of a parent, or perhaps another relative, in her case a parent, who represents so much to her. And I think we, the readers also see his virtues. He's a virtuous man, very good man.
Yes, and you bring people onto the scene who also knew Obed and speak of his virtues, and they all say, "And he knew cattle."
And he knew cattle.
Yes,
that's right. Every so often she meets somebody who says that they knew her father, and they always speak very highly of him.
I think that in your series of books about Maramatsu, that Africa is a character in the book.
Yes, I think that's right. And Botswana certainly is. Maramatsu is very aware of her context, her cultural context. She's proud of her country. She's proud of Botswana, and she's proud of Africa. That doesn't mean to say that she doesn't see the problems, mm-hmm. and it doesn't mean to say that she's unaware of difficulties. Mm-hmm. But she is a patriot.
At one point, she said, "My country has never done anything to make me ashamed."
Mm-hmm. Yes, she does say that. Mm-hmm. And I think she says that because she feels, rightly, that Botswana has, in general, behaved very correctly, right since independence in 1966.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say that there haven't been some issues. There always will be in any country's history. But they've observed the rule of law solidly and consistently since independence, which can't be said of all the countries in the region by any means.
Absolutely. I think that your knowledge of Africa and your sensitivity to the African ways must have something to do with the fact that you were born in what was then southern Rhodesia and that you went to school there, I believe.
Yes, well, I suppose I did have the good fortune of spending my childhood there. Not that I really understood or appreciated or necessarily responded to the moral challenges of being brought up there not that I responded particularly well. But later, of course, one can look back on one's childhood and early influences and put them in perspective and sort them out. Mm-hmm. So I've been lucky with having that background.
Were you in the city or were you out in the bush?
No, we lived in a place called Bulawayo, which is a rather nice town.
Oh, yes, I've been there.
Oh,
yes.
Well, then you'll know how.
With the wide streets.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh,
that's
yes.
Beautiful yeah. country there in the Topaz Hills.
Oh, lovely country. I love that part of the world, although I'm very out of touch with it now, and I haven't been there for a long, long time. I go to Botswana mm-hmm. regularly, and I've yes. become much more involved in Botswana. So I do get back there.
Well, that was really fun to hear Alexander McCall Smith again. Obviously, he's a great favorite of Suzanne's and mine because he was such a delight to work with under somewhat adverse circumstances.
Nah.
Yes. And before we move on to the next writer, this week we're having membership drive here at KRCB. And I want to thank so many of you who support us with your membership. And it would mean a great deal to Suzanne and me if those of you who are not yet members would call us here at the station at 584-2020 and become members. When you become a member, you'll get the Open Air, our monthly magazine that lists all the programs, and you'll be able to read the blurb in there from Novel Idea and know what book we're preparing next. And we also here at the station have some gifts in appreciation of your membership. So just keep us in mind and support us as much as you can.
And when you call in during a Novel Idea, and right now while we're yammering might be a good time for you to make that call to 584-2020. When you call in, suggest a book you might be interested in having us cover or perhaps an author that is a favorite of yours that we might like exploring, too. So we look at this as a conversation with you, our listeners, and this is a good time for letting us know what it is you're interested in.
Yes, and we could also mention that you can go to krcb.org on your computer and arrange your membership that way. So whatever way is most suitable for you.
I'll just say the number one more time, 584-2020.
The next author that we want to highlight is a local favorite, Jean Hegland, and her book, Windfalls. Perhaps you've read Jean's first book, Into the Forest, and then Windfalls, I believe, is her second book. Local writers are often willing to come into the studio so that we can interview them about their work. And I really like it when that happens because I think it adds a great deal to your listening pleasure if you can hear from the author herself. And Jean was magnificent in sharing with us some of the ideas that she was working with as she wrote Windfalls. Also in the studio with us that evening was Marcy Clausen of the Board of Directors of The Living Room. Jean did volunteer work at The Living Room to acquaint herself with the local arrangements for women who were homeless. And I felt that added a great deal to it as well, so that we had the local.
The community aspect. It was that day in the studio. It really was, I would characterize it as being a very warm setting. And in fact, I think that show had that kind of quality to it. And the conversation, I thought, was very open and ranging because of that.
Yes. Her two protagonists in the book are two women, Anna, who is a professional photographer, and Cerise, who has a very unfortunate time in life and actually for a while is a homeless person herself. And the book is told in alternating chapters. And we know that eventually this skillful author is going to bring them together, that their trajectories will cross. But we watch to see just how Jean Hegland is going to bring that about. And when that moment comes, it's so very interesting to see her two characters interact with each other. I thought it was a magnificent book.
And the similarity, I would say, between your conversation with Alexander McCall Smith and the conversation we had that day in the studio with Gene was how they spoke about the characters about which they write. Mm-hmm. And that's also a testament to you, Rosemary, in how you elicit that out of them in such a natural way.
Thank you. That's very kind. And now let's hear Jean Hagelin talking about her book.
It took, 5 to 7 years to write Windfalls and many uncountable drafts. And I kept waiting very optimistically for the title to descend. I thought that the muse would give me that at least. And so it was untitled for a long time and had all kinds of different titles. And finally, very, very near, it was almost in production, and still I wasn't satisfied with the title. Then Windfalls sort of appeared to me. I did finally get the little gift from the muse. The windfalls are an image in the book that actually almost a symbol. They become very, very important to the two main characters in the book.
I noticed how frequently you mention light.
I think on the one hand, it's very organic. And on the other hand, one of the main characters is a photographer. And so I was trying very much to experience the world through her eyes. And she would be noticing light. And light would have meaning to her. It's this sort of funny thing. When an image of light comes up, then that's the one you choose.
Right.
Over what? If she were a cook, you'd be thinking about food
right.
or tastes or something.
Yes. So now let's talk about Anna, the photographer. And you have a parallel structure. You have alternate sections in which you talk about Anna, and then you talk about the other character, Cerise. It's a form that I admired very much because it didn't look easy, but you kept it going. So we meet Anna, and she is in darkness when we meet her. She's in a dark and ugly place, mm-hmm. and those are they're just about the first words in the book, Anna in darkness.
When the story begins, Anna is in her early 20s. She's a graduate student, and she is afraid that she's pregnant.
And the father of that child was so inconsequential that you don't even reveal his name mm-hmm. in the book. He's just the sculptor.
The sculptor.
Which gives you some idea of how important he's going to be in the story. He will disappear. But as you leave her there in the lab, she says something so interesting. She's thinking about her sister Sally, who's a painter and whose painting career stopped when the little babies were born. And Anna says, the babies interrupted somebody's life. And then you take us from there to meet Cerise, who hates her name. And as we meet Cerise, she unlocks the door and enters her silent house, which is described as a sort of Twilight Zone rerun. It's a house which smells of unwashed nylons or unacknowledged disappointments.
Cerise, this takes place at the same time, but these young women, other than being young American women, are worlds apart. Cerise is a little younger. She's 15 or 16. She's one of those million kids that's lonely. She's awkward in her body. She lives with her mother. Her mother's very involved in her own life and not very interested in Cerise. She's one of those millions of kids who is at a very sort of sad, lonely point in her life without any direction. And yet she's got all these yearnings and all these, she's got this talent as a drawer that nobody, for drawing that nobody recognizes. Mm-hmm. And she's got a vast potential for kindness, but she's alone. She's mm-hmm. on her own.
So you start out with two women in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And the prognosis for neither of them looks very good at this point. And so the reader is then fascinated to see what will happen to them. Cerise does a really shocking thing early on. Her mother has left her a note saying, Cerise, fold laundry and iron. And as she's ironing, she takes the iron and burns her wrist. I was just shocked when she did that. I think you were demonstrating the depth of her desperation.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, very much. This need to make some kind of visible mark for how unhappy she is. And also, I think that she was feeling a hope at the time that someone would notice, that, you know, there's one more way that maybe she could make somebody notice her and either feel sorry for her or in some kind of unfortunate way be impressed by her courage. Mm-hmm. She needed to make a mark.
Yes, and she certainly did. It's an unforgettable scene. And then Anna, whom we met first, who was pregnant by the sculptor, decides to terminate the pregnancy. I felt that your character made the right decision for your character, and I thought you thoroughly validated it in your description of her trip to the clinic and then her very painful recovery. Again, all alone, nobody else knew. She didn't tell anybody. She just kept all that pain to herself.
I'm delighted that the book is being read that way. As I was writing it, a thing that I thought about a lot, well, a thing I've thought about way before I began writing this book, is how profoundly women's reproductive decisions affect our lives. And I think no matter what one's relationship to abortion, there's still a level of decision that takes place. And those decisions change our lives and shape our lives in probably more profound ways than any others, I think. And I think that for a young woman like Cerise, the very difficult choice she made was the right choice. It's remarkable how many women I've talked to since I've written this book who've shared to me their own stories about that particular crossroads. And a thing that struck me and continues to strike me so much is that each woman's relationship with those events and those decisions are so unique to that person. And a thing that gets lost perhaps in the sort of polarized debate that we're in America right now is the uniqueness of that experience, which is something that I wanted very much to exist in the book.
We're going to take a short break. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host for A Novel Idea, and Suzanne Lang, the producer, and I are talking about our 5 years on the air with A Novel Idea. The motif for our current membership drive is the little radio station that could. Just like the little engine that could, we're using all our power to get our message out. We are your community-powered radio station. And we invite you to join us to become a member of KRCB. How do you do that? Call this number, 584-2020. Your membership makes it possible for us to keep on bringing you local programs, The Voice of Youth, North Bay Report, music personally selected by KRCB Radio Guild volunteers, and literary programs every Wednesday evening at 7. So call now, 584-2020, and become a member of the little radio station that could. Suzanne, I was thinking about some of those early shows that we did. As I mentioned before, we didn't originate the show. It was Janine Sternlieb who had the idea, did the show for several years. But when I first came on doing the show, that was a pretty steep learning curve. And of course, there I was where everybody could hear me making those mistakes and learning to do this work. And I'm sure some of our early shows were
a little rough.
A little rough. That's a good way to put it.
Well, the wonderful thing about radio, I think it does fortify one's character, because you just have to get over it and move on.
And you have to keep talking.
You have to keep moving.
Well, I noticed that when you came on to do the show with me and to produce the show, things definitely got better because you had an idea of how to shape the material. Then we began to pre-record, which I think helped the quality of the show enormously.
Well, and I think that our pre-recording the show does help with the flexibility when we do get authors. We're not tied to 7 o'clock the second Wednesday of every month, but we hope you're tied to the second Wednesday of every month and in your listening habits.
That's right. And how do we get our authors? Well, with local authors, we can arrange studio time at their convenience. And then, of course, Suzanne and I do a great deal of preparation. We both read the book or the books and become as familiar as we can with the writers and some of their other work. And then the authors come into the studio and we do the interview right here.
And authors, they like talking about their books.
Yes.
And sometimes, really, you just have to invite them. And they're happy to have that conversation. Or that's what I've discovered, at least, is
that's
that
true.
They're often very generous.
Yes. And since we get to choose the books, we only do books that we like. And then that that makes it much easier to talk with a writer about a book that we've read and that we really enjoy.
And some of the guests we like to have on the show are people who enjoy talking about books.
Yes.
And we'll be listening to one of those people pretty soon in our next excerpt.
Right. That's right. Well, let's get to the next program that we want to highlight. I think it's my favorite show of all the shows that we've done for 5 years, and it's certainly one of my favorite books. The book is Gilead, written by Marilyn Robinson. It won the Pulitzer Prize. Marilyn Robinson writes a book every generation. It had been 23 years since she'd written a book, and the guest for that program was one of our all-time favorites, J.J. Wilson, professor emeritus from Sonoma State University. And she and I both really loved this book. And so I thought we had a great conversation about it. We weren't able to have an interview with Marilyn Robinson because she doesn't do many interviews. But we talked a lot about her and about the wonderful characters that she created.
And J.J. added such a context, not just about the book, but about the book in this world of literature.
Yes.
And just so eloquent in her ability to articulate that.
And you know, the day she came in, she was so tired that she wasn't even sure she could do it. But boy, did she come to life.
She did perk up.
And I was thinking about that night that Jerry Haslam came in to do a program with us, and he was sick. He had a terrible cold, but, you know, he's such a trooper. He came in anyway. And then when Jonah Raskin just recently did the program about Doris Lessing, he was sick that night. But again, you never would have known it from listening to that program because he was fabulous.
And I think that it's talking about something that they love and mm-hmm. something that excites them, cuts through the illness, cuts through the sniffles. Rosemary, why did you like that book so much? Why were you attracted to it?
I saw a piece of it first in The New Yorker, and I started reading it. And it just grabbed me. And I immediately turned back to where they list the authors because I thought, who's Marilyn Robinson? I don't think I've heard that name before. And they don't say much about in the bio in The New Yorker. Just said, I think they might have said she taught at the graduate writers program at University of Iowa, which is, of course, is the Yale and Harvard of writing programs. And the content just spoke to me. I actually know a couple of people who didn't like the book. And I keep scratching my head about that. How could anyone not like this book?
I think maybe because Robinson's, quote, plain writing style.
Yes.
Perhaps some readers need a little bit more in-your-face kind of action. Mm-hmm. And certainly that's the way media is today.
Yes.
Everything has to be kind of going and paced fast and frenetic. And this book is not that way.
That's right. And J.J. said, don't read this book fast. Read this book slowly.
to take your time and savor
take
it.
Take your
yes.
time.
Had you read Housekeeping?
I can't remember if I read that before or after I read Gilead. And it's a wonderful book, but it's much more intricate and not nearly as linear as Gilead. And it didn't grab me the same way. there are other people who prefer housekeeping to Gilead.
Well, that's more of the Marilyn Robinson enigma.
Right, right.
Well, before we listen to that, I want to remind listeners that this is our spring pledge drive, and we are the little station that could, and this is the little program that can, and I hope you will be the person who decides to become a member this evening of KRCB. We are public radio for Sonoma County, and our program is just one of many of the locally produced, locally hosted shows. We are a rare station these days that has so many really high-quality shows that are locally produced, locally programmed. We look forward to your support. And give us a call today at 584-2020 and let Rosemary know what you'd like to read next, what you'd like her to read next, and become a member today.
Yeah. And now let's go to Marilyn Robinson's book, Gilead. I first heard about this book from you. Do you remember where you heard about the book?
I read it last January and have reread it, of course, since. Mm-hmm. I heard about it for the very good reason that I'm one of the Marilyn Robinson waiters. We've all been faithfully waiting for 23 years for her next novel, since Housekeeping. And when it came, I didn't miss it. I dashed right out and bought it in hardback, I must say.
23 years and worth every minute of it.
Absolutely.
It's a stunning book. The book won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction this year.
Isn't that marvelous? Makes me think better of the Pulitzer, I have to say. Yes. I think what I respect about their doing it is the topic was so unpopular, so un-New York, so not fashionable. It's a very unfashionable novel.
Yes, it is.
And I do admire, I think it's a sign of what a triumph it is
That's
over
right.
fashion.
I wanted to ask you, as a professor of English for ever so long, what about current fiction? When you're teaching English and teaching literature, do current books come onto your radar, or are you chiefly wedded to the classics and to what's called the canon, whatever that might be?
What an interesting question. I can't generalize about it because it's different. I know when I was at Berkeley, it seemed to me that they never got past, you know, we sort of started with Chaucer and worked our way up to Yeats, and we didn't get much further ahead than that. But Sonoma State is lighter on its feet, and Thane Stearns now teaches a course in the experimental novel, which works with older experiments, but also brings it right up to contemporary times.
Uh-huh.
So I think we like to use the class as a way, and probably the way you use your program, to get people to read the classics so that they know what the present novelists are responding to and in a way in dialogue with.
Okay.
You understand contemporary novels much better if you've read the older novels with which they've nourished themselves also. I can tell, for instance, that Marilyn Robinson has read Virginia Woolf.
Yes.
And I can see other kinds. She talks about the wonderful novel about the priest, The Diary of a Country Priest.
And
she talks in the book about books. That,
yes, she does.
So she leaves you some traces of what she thinks are forerunners of her own novel. You know, it may all be one large novel, just evolving since the 18th century to now. They all write in a way to and with one another. So the more you can read of them, the better.
Yes.
I don't believe in a complete diet of contemporary novels.
No. Do you think Gilead will become a classic?
It already has for me because I've read it more than once, and in a way that, you know, and getting more out of it each time I read it.
Yes.
And so I think that's what a classic does. It continues to feed you.
Mm-hmm.
If you have something that's a very extremely trendy looking dress, or you won't be able to wear it again next year, probably.
Right.
But since she's already so unfashionable, now I don't mean by that dowdy, but I mean that she's made her choices not on the basis of fashions, then it will probably last longer than something that it seems to hit the spot right away.
Yes. Yeah, I certainly hope so, because I find so much in this book of lasting value. And I hope that we'll be able to inspire our listeners to read it if they haven't already. And the listeners who have already, we're going to do our very best to do justice to this this beautiful work. You mentioned her earlier work, which she published 23 years ago, Housekeeping. I also heard about Housekeeping the first time from you. And as you say, it's not about dusting. Could you just tell us just a little bit about Housekeeping to tweak people's interest in that one?
It's an adorable book. I love it. It is probably not going to be a classic. It's so eccentric.
It's, yes, it is. It's very different. Know.
And it, too, is very American, I have to say. It's all about hobos and trains and things like that, the big, the West.
I mean, and she floods.
Floods and fires. And is also very oriented to the female.
Uh-huh.
The females are all the main players in this. And that is not true of the next book she wrote, Gilead.
Yes,
so
right.
You have a really hard time knowing that it's, you know, what she's going to do next, Marilynne Robinson. Mm-hmm. And but this book I do recommend for people who are interested in, who maybe have had a wonderful auntie who, like Aunt Sylvia, Aunt Sylvia, whatever you all say, slept with her shoes under her pillow. You know, if you know that kind of very, you're not ever sure you really, that Aunt, you're going to persuade Aunt Sylvia to stay. You want to be particularly charming so that she'll stay, because mm-hmm. life is more interesting with Aunt Sylvia around.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a deep book and mm-hmm. very lyrical, and I've never read a book like it. Maybe it will be a classic anyway.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Tell me about Marilynne Robinson.
From what I understand of Marilynne Robinson, she is a curmudgeon a bit. She loves teaching. It's not that. She doesn't take that pose that some writers do of, I would rather be writing than teaching a writing workshop. She says she learns constantly from those workshops, and if she didn't, she wouldn't do it. But she never regrets a minute she spends teaching. She spends her time doing a lot of environmental work also. As you know, she works closely with the Congregationalist Church. She puts in her time there and does sermons even. She's asked to give sermons and to represent the church in various ways. But she doesn't feel the need to talk theoretically. She's not as interested. The theory that she's fascinated by is theology rather than literary theory, I gather. And part of this is her commitment, because I think it's one of the strengths of the book, and I think it's an important critique of our present society, which she often represents. She,
yeah.
she really is the kind of person who can always see the other side to a
yes.
situation. And
mm-hmm.
that's part of her strength and maybe part of, you know, she's opinionated. But she is a great believer in primary research, in going not to secondary materials, but to going to the primary material. Now, that may sound like a rather uncontroversial thing to say, but when she tells you things like, what about all those Marxists who never read Marx, she says? What about all the people who disapprove of Calvinism, but they've never read John Calvin? And she can go on about that for quite a while. She is fascinated by John Calvin. She thinks he started American society, that his principles are behind a good deal of the best in American society. And she thinks the fact that people only read secondary sources on him causes a good deal of misunderstanding. I've heard people say the same thing about Freud, that those of us who easily dismiss Mr. Freud would do well to read him. Mm-hmm. And we would see there's much a benefit there. And so let me move it quickly to our wonderful novel and say that the history in the book, you wouldn't call it an historical novel, it's so much about the individual, but it is grounded so beautifully in the times and in the great issues of American life that it gains from that a gravitas and a seriousness and a groundedness that makes it quite different from a novel that wouldn't have been so carefully researched. So here, it's not only a criticism that Marilynne Robinson gives of society that, she, as she sees, going far too much to secondary sources and to trends and to slogans and to not thinking things through and to easily dismissing the contribution of the church to American life and to the life of the individual development and all that, then you also see that she can apply that to her own work and do what she mm-hmm. says other people ought to do. Mm-hmm. And it's a very reassuring part of the novel. And mm-hmm. I'm taking her very seriously.
Yes, I am too.
Good.
I am too. And not only beautifully reasoned, but so beautifully written. Mm-hmm. I found that the writing just drew me in. The writing is so smooth and so magnificent. I don't know when I've underlined as many things in a book as I have in Gilead.
We would recommend people reading it for the first time. Don't rush this book.
That's right.
It wasn't written rapidly, and it shouldn't be read rapidly.
That's right.
As I've been reading it over by way of preparation here, I was amazed by the rhythmic quality of it. It's sort of like the rise and fall of the narrator's thoughts that
yes.
seem as even as mm-hmm. breath in mm-hmm. some way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's part of the beauty, I mm-hmm. think. And you wouldn't expect it because it is described, and rightly so, as a very plain style. It's not ornate. It's mm-hmm. not as fancy as mm-hmm. even as housekeeping is.
I've been talking about Gilead to a lot of people and telling them, you must read this book. And they ask me, well, what's the book about? So when I was rereading it in preparation for our discussion, I started a list of themes. What is this book about? And here's what I came up with for starters. It's about death, love, beauty, home, laughter, anger and temper, wisdom, prayer, and water. And that's up to page 6. So there's amazing things in this book. I found that if I told people that it was in the form of a letter written by a minister to his young son and that he was the third generation of ministers, I lost my audience.
Oh.
Their eyes glazed over. Oh, and my own eyes glazed over at the thought. So I found myself saying, no, wait, you've got to read it. It's really, really good. You'll love it. What do you say to people about the book?
I say, I won't speak to you until you've read Gilead. No, wait a minute. Let me be better than that. I say, trust the author, trust Marilynne Robinson to carry you, to make even such an unappetizing topic your story in
yes.
a strange and wonderful way.
Yes.
And I think it is a book that young people would do well to read, partly because it will train them maybe to listen better to older people and to see that how alive they are and how, in the case of this wonderful character, he is able to change. I mean, one of the things that good literature is supposedly about is it takes someone who's maybe not good or perfect, and it shows them learning something and changing. And what you're scared of, your friends are frightened of when they hear you describe the book, is that this minister is going to be someone so good, and you're going to have to stick with someone who's just awfully good for the whole book, and then he dies. The marvelous thing is that he is entirely human. He is indeed worthy of our admiration, but he changes. He learns something. And I'm going to say he doesn't die at the end. I'm going to, that is not the point mm-hmm. of the book. You
right.
don't have to have the big funeral scene at the end. And he talks about his moving into the realm of imperishability.
Hmm.
And this book moves him to that range, certainly this character that Marilynne Robinson has invented.
Before we get into the story, I'm going to make a couple of disclosures and disclaimers on a personal basis. First of all, this book is set in Iowa and in Kansas on the prairies, and I grew up in Kansas, but I don't usually read books about the Midwest unless it's a send-up, like Jane Smiley's books, Thousand Acres and Moo. And, of course, What's the Matter with Kansas, which traces the roots of the conservative movement to my home state. My favorite Kansas author is Calvin Trillin, who grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, not Kansas at all, but that's close enough. And he left Kansas as soon as he could, just as I did, and went in search of a little more sophistication. So that's my first disclosure and disclaimer. The second one, there are only two. Second one is this. This book is about ministers and their wives and their children and congregation and parsonages. I was married to a minister for more than 30 years. I lived in parsonages. I raised four children in parsonages. But I tend to shy away from a lot of popular fiction that deals with religion. And I find that novels that are written about the wife of the minister, like Joanne Trollope's spine book, The Rector's Wife, they sort of stack the deck. By the time her protagonist was eligible to remarry, she had her choice of three eligible men, one rich, one handsome, one brilliant. And I thought, get real, Joanna. And my experience with the hierarchy of the church has nurtured a certain skepticism, maybe even cynicism in me. And Marilynne Robinson caught me off guard. I think it was the writing. Would you read just the first couple of sentences again, J.J.?
Oh, I would be honored to. I told you last night that I might be gone sometime, and you said, where? And I said, to be with the good Lord, and you said, why? And I said, because I'm old, and you said, I don't think you're old. And you put your hand in my hand, and you said, you aren't very old. As if that settled it.
During the time that JJ and I were talking about this, I brought forward an idea that I'd had. It seemed a little off the wall, but I wanted to see what JJ thought of it. Those of you who have read Gilead know that the protagonist, John Ash, the third generation of ministers, has married a wife who's much younger than he is. And the whole book is a letter that he's writing to their young son, who is seven. And in the book, Robinson tells about how the young wife just appeared in church one day, almost as if by magic, and then kept appearing. One Sunday she didn't appear, and he realized he was in love with her. I said to JJ, you know, I think that Marilynne Robinson meant that young wife to be an angel. And then JJ and I talked about the characteristics that she had that were indeed often brought forth as those of an angel. But since we weren't able to talk to Marilynne Robinson, we couldn't check it out. It was several weeks after the broadcast, JJ called me and said that a friend of hers had gone to hear Marilynne Robinson in San Francisco, and someone in the audience had asked that question about an angel. And Marilynne Robinson had said, yeah, well, yes, as a matter of fact, I did intend her to be an angel. And that just gave me goosebumps, because what I thought had been, you know, a really wild suggestion turned out to be what the author had in mind. Do you think maybe you could play a piece, that particular piece of the interview?
Yeah, let's do that.
John Ames has such interesting things to say about envy. And
yes. Oh,
really,
yes.
I should say Marilynne Robinson places such interesting thoughts in his words about envy. He said he always envied men who could watch their wives grow old.
Yes.
And, of course, he confesses to having envy for Boughton with all those children. And in his lonely years, there were some moments of joy. And I think those joys, the writer is preparing us for the miracle of love.
Mm-hmm.
And a most astounding thing happens to John Ames. She appeared in church from nowhere on Pentecost Sunday. Now, Pentecost is a day in springtime which has great significance in the church calendar. It's a day of great excitement and symbolic mystery. Traditionally, the Holy Spirit descended on a gathering of early Christians in the form of a dove, and flames appeared, and they began to speak in unintelligible languages. Marilynne Robinson is well-versed in religion and theology. When she places this event on Pentecost Sunday, she knows the reverberations that it's going to cause in people who are familiar with the story. And she does this so often. Her biblical references are not always blatant, but if you know a great deal about the Bible, it's like a chime that she rings every so often. She hits that gong and you think, oh yeah, I recognize that context. So John Ames was struck with her wonderful seriousness. The man is smitten, What a scandal for the congregation. Mercy. One Sunday, she failed to appear, and he thought, I am sick with love, which, of course, is directly from the Song of Solomon, a part of the Bible that he probably hadn't thought much about for a good many years. You know, J.J., I think she's an angel. This is the reason I think that Marilynne Robinson has planted her here as an angel, is because of the subtext. Her look of, her serious
look. Her fierce look.
Her fierce, mm-hmm. fierce, stern. He describes her in all these. And it, to me, it's a scene very much like the Annunciation, you know, where the angel comes to the Virgin Mary and says, you will have a child. The authority with which the angels speak. Because as they go on, she tells him, I think you should marry me. And that comes to him kind of out of the blue. He said, I would never have had the courage to ask her. And she seems to know that. To me, seeing her as an angel doesn't spoil the story in any way. It simply takes it to another realm. I think, what is the author up to here, presenting in physical form so many attributes of an angel?
Here's one sentence right from the first page.
Tell me.
I've always been a little surprised to find my eyebrows unsinged after I've suffered one of those looks. That's the looks that she gives him. And then the beautiful last four words, I will miss them.
You think that there might be something to my theory of that that's what the author might be up to?
When you first said it, it mm-hmm. surprised me. But
yes.
when I looked back over the book, there uh-huh. seemed to me many signs. Now, I yeah. haven't met many angels, I must admit. Uh-huh. And I don't know. Some of them are highly sentimentalized,
yes.
let's face it.
Oh, yes, of
yeah.
course.
So I'm a little dubious about giving someone angel status uh-huh. too quickly. But I came to believe she was sent mm-hmm. to keep him company.
Yes.
yes.
I loved revisiting Gilead. Those of you who haven't read it, I hope you will. The more often you read it, the more you get out of it. I think it's just one of the most outstanding books of our time, and also a good read. But remember to read slowly.
To read slowly. And you can listen on krcb.org. All the shows that we are referencing this evening are available on demand at krcb.org.
Mm-hmm. Along with our current shows and recent shows. So it's go to the menu and pick out a show and enjoy. Well, speaking of enjoying, I've enjoyed so much revisiting some of our highlights and lowlights in our 5 years here at Novel Idea. And I'm thinking about that shelf of books I have at home of books that I want to do in the future, and I'm sure you have a similar shelf. And we look forward to bringing you more books and hope that you'll let us know if there's a particular book you'd like to hear.
And there's a good way for you to let us know. Email us. You could always email us either at listener@krcb.org or anovelidea@krcb.org. But the best way for you to let us know what you'd like to hear us cover on this show is to give us a call right now at the station at 584-2020. This is our Spring Pledge Drive, and it would be a wonderful time for you to become a member of Public Radio for Sonoma County.
Yes, it would be an entirely appropriate time for you to call the station at 584-2020. I wonder if you're aware that every Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, there's a program about books. It's unusual for a small station to have this much self-generated programming, but to have 4 hours a month about books, that is really an accomplishment, and we're very proud of it. The first Wednesday of the month, Gil Manserg does Word by Word, and he interviews writers and talks about their work. Then on the second Wednesday of the month, you hear Novel Idea. The third Wednesday at 7 is Catherine Hastings brings Word Temple. Catherine Hastings seems to know all the poets there are, and she brings the very finest, the best poets, onto her program Word Temple. And I know you'll enjoy Catherine. And then on the fourth Wednesday, David Templeton brings Page on Stage, a lively and very interesting program. So every Wednesday night at 7, It's Gil, it's the two of us, it's Catherine, and then it's David. So mark that on your calendar, Wednesday evening at 7. And if you're not already a member of KRCB, think of supporting us with your membership. So call us at 584-2020. We'll be back next month to bring you a novel idea. And until that time, remember, there's no such thing as too many books.